Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm producer Emily Means, and today on the program, President Donald Trump signs an executive order calling for a review of all national monument designations from the past 21 years, including Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments in Utah. A week after being fired from the position, Huntsman Cancer Institute CEO Mary Beckerle is reinstated in it, and it's an exciting time to be a Utah Jazz fan as the team goes into what they hope is the last game in this playoff series against the Los Angeles Clippers. Those stories, plus your underplayed stories of the week, and more on the show today. And joining me for this conversation in the studio, we have government and politics editor Dan Harry. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Emily.
Good morning. It's good to see you. We also have George Pyle, editorial writer at the Salt Lake Tribune. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
And Alex Stuckey here for, I think, the third week in a row, actually. We're going to name a studio after you soon, I think. Health and education reporter. Thank you for being here, Alex.
Yep.
And we also have Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr on the phone. Hi, Tommy. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Good morning.
Good. It's good to have you here with us. And we're excited to talk about all these different topics. Remember, you can join us with your thoughts, questions, and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also comment on our Facebook page, KCPW 88.3. Also, just a teaser, for the end of the hour, we'll be talking about the Jazz with reporters Aaron Falk and Tony Jones. But to start off with, I want to take a look at national news first. So, Tommy, we're going to you. This week, President Trump has signed yet another executive order, and this one hits kind of close to home for Utahns.
That it does. So this is not too much of a surprise. I think the Utah delegation has been crying for some kind of action from the White House, especially looking at the Bears Ears National Monument, which everyone recalls President Obama named in late December before he left office. Controversial, for sure. A lot of tribal leaders wanted this. A lot of environmental community wanted this, but local and state leaders did not. And so this really does come at the behest of Senator Orrin Hatch and the other members of the delegation, but President Trump really thanked Senator Orrin Hatch for calling him relentlessly to push this through. And what the order does is essentially say to the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke that he has 45 days to report back on what changes or even a possible rescission of the Bears Ears National Monument. And then within 120 days, Zinke has to come back a report looking at about 30 monuments going back to and especially including the Grand Staircase Monument, which President Clinton named in 1996.
So what do they expect to come out of Ryan Zinke's review in this 45 days?
Well, so Ryan Zinke was very clear that he didn't want to prejudge what he was going to do. He said, this isn't a political review. This is going to be, you know, talking to all the stakeholders from, you know, the senators and congressmen to governors to local officials, tribes, environmental groups, and come back and say, you know, are these monuments the right size? Should they be tweaked some? Should Bears Ears go through a different process and start over again? But the president and Vice President Mike Pence were pretty clear in their comments when he was signing the order that they're going to free up land and they're going to return the power back to the state. So they were already kind of prejudging that Zinke was going to come back with a report that says, yeah, we've got to get rid of Bears Ears. We've got to cut these, you know, millions of acres of marine resources and put them back under federal control, but not the same protection as a national monument.
Right. So Zinke's going to talk to all these different people, and of these people, who is protesting?
That's a lot of people to talk to, by the way. If you're talking about 30 monuments and different stakeholders for each one of those
in 45 days,
a lot of things. We expect Zinke to be in Utah in early May. He told me, and he's going to go to Bears Ears and he's going to talk to people there. You know, the biggest thing here is the environmental community. So this is a very dangerous idea that going back to look at these monuments, which were already there was already a review done of these before they were named. In the case of Grand Staircase, it's been in place for 21 years. There's a lot of things, numbers you can look at for economics for the communities of how they've been affected. Grand Staircase is more popular in Utah, for example, now than it was in 1996. So the environmental community is very concerned that this is just a political game, that Trump's going to come in and say, after this report comes out, well, we've got to change all these monuments. And if he does try to get rid of, for example, Bears Ears National Monument, this would be the first time ever in the history of the Antiquities Act, which is 101 years old, that a president has got rid of a monument designated by his predecessor.
Right, so there's no real precedent for this. Dan, I want to go to you. Since no one has undone designation yet, what do lawmakers think they'll be able to do with that land if it, you know, if the boundaries are shrunk or even if the monument is undone?
Well, what they want to do is open it up primarily for extraction of natural resources, which only certain parts of this even, you know, contain things that you would want to extract. I think there are some coal deposits inside of the Bears Ears Monument that you could get at. Of course, coal was a huge factor, debate and controversy. I'm old enough to remember when Grand Staircase was created and there were cries that they were cutting off access to one of the nation's biggest coal fields. The problem is, you know, the nation and the world's appetite for coal has diminished incredibly. And so it really is questionable whether a lot of these projects that would have been feasible, you know, 30, 40 years ago are feasible today. One of the things is access. I mean, in a lot of these places, actually to get to that kind of resource, you would have to build roads. You would have to then, you know, set up mining operations, and it's very expensive. And the return is just questionable whether it's there. So, you know, part of it is opening it up to these companies. The other part of it is a lot of it is symbolic. They, I think from the Trump administration's point of view, they're trying to undo anything that President Obama ever did. And this is a continuation of that. And for the Utah delegation, they've made political hay out of the public lands issues. It's the federal government versus state control for, you know, decades now. And this is a continuation of that. I think they will find themselves in sort of a same place they are with the Obamacare fight, which is, okay, if you finally get what you want, the, you know, what are you going to do? So I would have a hard time seeing them undoing the Grand Staircase National Monument. As Tommy said, it's been there for 21 years. Public opinion polls now show that it has majority support even in Utah, let alone the country. So to undo that, I think, is not going to happen. You might see some boundary adjustments there. Bears Ears is a different matter. I mean, I think they might try to undo the whole thing altogether. But that's not the end of the story. What happens then is, because this has never been done before, you're automatically going to have legal challenges. And that is going to drag. That's expensive, and it's going to take a long time. And so you could very well see a scenario where the president signs such an order to do away with Bears Ears, lawsuits are filed, this gets litigated for many years, and by the time the first term of the Trump administration is over, it's not settled. So that is very well the way this could play out.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. It could play out anyway, right?
Could play out other ways, too. But that's kind of my best guess is what we'll see.
Do you really think this was just like an in-your-face Obama kind of move? I mean, especially with Orrin Hatch having a pretty big hand in this, as he has said, right?
Yeah, that's part of it. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, as Sally Jewell pointed out in an interview with the Tribune the other day, and she's been quiet, you know, since the end of the Obama administration, but she felt the urge to speak up the other day and defend the creation of the monument, which she had a big role in, and pointed out, as we've known before, that this the contours of this monument pretty well match what Rob Bishop had proposed in his legislation, the Public Lands Initiative, And so that's one thing the Obama administration points to and said, look, this claim that we didn't listen to the people, that we only listened to one side of the argument is wrong, and here's proof. You know, we changed what originally was a larger proposed monument and shrunk the boundaries down to the size that it would have matched what was in this legislation.
Right, and I want to talk about some of those people that they talked with. Tommy, many state leaders have said local native tribes are opposed to Bears Ears, but groups such as, you know, Utah Dene Bekea or the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition really push for this designation. So I'm wondering, how will tribal sovereignty play into this, especially since Zinke says he'll meet with different tribes?
Yeah, this will be interesting. The Utah delegation and the governor often point to some Navajos who are opposed to this, but clearly the math is against them. I think there were six of the seven tribal chapters, in the area that supported this. One did not, but those numbers obviously definitely favor a creation of a monument. And you are going to find people like Rebecca Denali from San Juan County who opposed this, but if Zinke is going to meet with these tribal leaders, they're going to say, you know, this is the first monument that the federal government listened to us and created because we want to protect our sacred cultural areas. And that's going to really hurt Zinke's attempt to try to change it or get rid of Bears Ears when it becomes a sovereignty thing versus just a, you know, how do we manage these lands necessarily.
George Pyle, what do you think this executive order says to tribal nations?
Well, it's just a slap. I mean, talk about, you know, an in-your-face to Obama. It's a big slap at the nations, the five nations that went together, that asked for this, that, and went through all the process and said that this is important to us. And it is a sovereignty nation-to-nation kind of thing. There are individual Navajos and others who are opposed to the monument, just as there are individual Americans who are opposed to who our president is and individual Jews who are opposed to how Israel runs its business. Just because you happen to be of a certain ethnic group doesn't mean you speak for all of people who are in that ethnic group. The official recognized sovereign nation tribes, I mean, they're mentioned in the Constitution, the various Indian nations, they're for this. And they really resent the idea that their official governing bodies have been ignored and that they go around and find, oh, here's an Indian over here. She's against it, so she speaks for all Indians and being against it because I'm against it. And also, I mean, they have to continue to tell these lies, basically, that there was no process, that nobody was listened to, that nobody had, this was just a total whim of this faraway president, and it was no such thing. And they also talk about a land grab. Well, how can you grab your own land? This has been federal land since it was Mexican land, then it became United States land. They try and give you the impression that there was all these like private landowners out there who were actively making money by mining coal and running cattle, and all of a sudden this mean old federal government came and snapped it all up. That's just false. It's been Bureau of Land Management land. It's been managed by the federal government, well or poorly, depending on your point of view, but that's what it is. And they haven't locked it up. It was already managed by the federal government. You had to go through lots of plans and permitting processes and everything if you wanted to mine or drill or graze. So the idea that, you know, they have taken this thriving economy and cut it up, pulled it up short, is just false. And all these people all around Utah, they want to say, well, you know, we're not spending enough money on education. Well, it's because the mean old federal government has all the land locked up. But if you look across the country, it's a rural area, period. I mean, you can be next to a national monument, you can be next to a giant wheat field. It's a rural area. They're all across the country, drying up and blowing away. Younger generation is leaving. The school closes. Maybe the post office is all you've got left. And you look at these maps where they talk about how, okay, you know, like 60% of Utah is federal land, 80% of whatever it is of Nevada is federal land. You look in states where there's no federal land. It's the same thing. Small towns are drying up and blowing away. Industry is not coming. Kids grow up, go off to college, never come home. The people in San Juan County and our own senators are telling us, well, if we just got this land away from the federal government, that process would reverse. it's not reversing in all the other states that have no federal land. It's just not true.
Right. It's not a quick fix.
No.
Tommy, I'm going to go back to you. In his signing, I guess, didn't Trump say that this should never have happened? I don't know exactly what that refers to. I feel like he wasn't very specific about that. What should never have happened?
I think it was pretty clear in the context he was talking about bear's ears.
Okay.
How he said it was kind of general, but he's looking over at Orrin Hatch when he's saying it, so I think he's definitely referring to bear's ears. And listen, the president very much forms his opinions on who he talks to, whom he talks to, and Orrin Hatch has been in his ear about this since probably even before the inauguration of Trump. And so what Trump is hearing is this is a bad thing. It's the opposite of phenomenal or the opposite of fantastic, as he usually likes to call things. So I think Trump is going to, the order is very vague in what he wants the results to be, but I think it's clear the order verbally has been, we need to do something to change this.
Right. I'm wondering if you think this is actually an issue that's of particular interest to Trump. Was it? I feel like he didn't mention it much in his campaign.
No, absolutely. This was never a talking point he used. This is not something that he ever, even I think when he came to Utah, I don't think he mentioned this at all. Trump has a lot of priorities. As Dan said, a lot of them are reversing what Obama did. In this case, this is essentially the Utah delegation, Senator Orrin Hatch, finally got to the president and got him to take some action on this. But it's not something they're really talking about in their 100 days resume or list of accomplishments they've done. So this isn't a big deal necessarily to the White House, but it is a big deal to the delegation. And we all know Trump needs Orrin Hatch if he wants to get, some things like tax reform through. He's a very key player on the Hill. So this is a favor to Senator Hatch.
Right. Well, I guess we'll see what Ryan Zinke has to say in about 45 days.
It's on the calendar.
It's on the calendar. Mark your calendars, everybody. Tommy, I know you have to leave pretty quickly here, but I want to touch on one more story that you did. Representative Jason Chaffetz, again in the news, says he's not running for office in 2018, and he's probably stepping down early. And Tommy, I don't know if you can tell us exactly what happens if he does that. I guess there are no real rules in place, and some Utah lawmakers seem confused about the process, too.
Yeah, I think we have a split between the legislative branch and the executive branch in Utah. So no one in the history of the House in Utah has ever stepped down. So all of our representatives have there was one who died once upon a time, but he was replaced through a general election, essentially. So what we have is a situation where the law is pretty vague. All it says is if there's a vacancy in a congressional seat, the governor calls a special election. But it doesn't say you go through a convention, a caucus, and a primary, and then the general election, special election. It just kind of says calls an election. So there are some lawmakers who are very concerned that there could be, 30, 40 candidates who run in something like that, and somebody could win the seat with, 11% of the vote. So the Utah Democrats, the Utah Republicans are asking the governor to call a special session. The House Speaker's calling for the governor to call a special session. But the governor told me this week he's very concerned about people trying to game the system, that there are several lawmakers who would like to replace Chaffetz, and they may try to set it up so that, they have the best chance to win the seat. I guess we'll see how this plays out in the end, but right now the law is pretty vague. The governor thinks it's fine. The legislative branch says, nope, we need to fix it.
George, do you think state legislators who are considering this seat can be unbiased in this decision?
Oh, politicians trying to game the system. Who would have ever thought that was going to happen? The governor right now has pretty much power to do whatever he wants, and like every other executive in the world, doesn't want any of that power taken away. So just because it's power, who wants to give that up? Plus, it's a certain measure of efficiency. Congressional terms are only 2 years anyway, and to get this ramped up, if Chaffetz decides that he's having his foot operated on yesterday, and he's just tired of Washington, and he's got this gig coming up on Fox News or something. If he does step down early, it'll leave a year basically in his term. And we had a comment on the online the other day. Let's just leave the seat vacant. Our congressmen don't do anything for us anyway. And there's an argument to that. I mean, the Republicans have a majority in the House. Jason Chaffetz's vote one way or the other probably won't make much difference. He wasn't going to investigate the Trump administration anyway. So it's kind of like, just leave it. But it does make sense, though, just in a general sense, that there ought to be rules for how you fill this kind of vacancy. To write them on the fly when there's a vacancy staring you in the face probably isn't the best way to do it, but nobody ever thought of it before.
Dan, when do you think we'll see Representative Chaffetz step down?
It's hard to say. You know, I was kind of thinking that when he had his 12-year-old foot injury flare up and said he'd be out of commission for 3 to 4 weeks, it was kind of deja vu. This is sort of
Is this from kicking? Sorry. Is this from kicking at BYU?
No, it's really not. He fell off a ladder. I think he was doing something in his garage 12 years ago. He was then, at that time, chief of staff to Governor John Huntsman. And it really put him out of commission for months on end, and he never returned to the job. So I was kind of speculating that this might be the end of his chairmanship on the Oversight Committee, that do they really want the chairman of that committee to be out of commission for at least 3 to 4 weeks and perhaps longer. But Tommy, I think you interviewed Chaffetz yesterday on the subject, and he said he had no intention at present of stepping down as chairman. So,
no, in fact, he said he's only going to miss he missed yesterday's votes in the House. He said he's going to miss about 4 days of next week of them in session, but then they're out of session for a little bit. He says there's no reason to step down. He can still be there, maybe on crutches, but he can still be around.
Yeah, a lot of speculation that he will step down by the end of this year, maybe even mid-year, and so we'll see. And there's a lot of jockeying for position right now for people who would like to win that seat.
I guess we'll see. And Tommy, we'll hear from you when it happens. So thank you so much for
absolutely.
Joining us. And have a great day, Tommy. We'll hear from you next time. All right. When we come back, a stressful week up at the University of Utah, but not just for students who forgot to study this semester. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young. 25 years ago, I met the people who got up from their TVs to rescue trucker Reginald Denny during the LA riots.
At this time, I said, God, this guy's getting beat crazily. You know, he's really getting beat. And I thought maybe somebody need to go down there and stop that.
How are the rescuers today? Next time, Here and Now.
Join us for the second half of Here and Now today at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Canadian musician Leslie Feist, or Feist, will be here. She's releasing Pleasure, her first album in 6 years. Some are saying her best record yet. She'll talk about how she hopes it'll motivate fans to look at the world with brighter eyes. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Behind the Headlines. I'm Emily Means with KCPW, and I'm joined in studio by Salt Lake Tribune health and education reporter Alex Stuckey, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and editorial writer George Pyle. And before we get started, are any of you interested in making a disclaimer about the ownership of the Salt Lake Tribune?
Well, we should all make a disclaimer. Paul Huntsman, the son of John Huntsman Sr., is the owner and publisher of the Salt Lake Tribune, and we make sure that we note that in every story that touches upon the Huntsman family or the Cancer Institute.
Thank you for doing that as we go into this story about the Huntsman Cancer Institute. Alex, this is the second week in a row you've been on to talk about a bit of drama regarding the leadership up at the Huntsman Cancer Institute and the University of Utah. Can you catch us up to speed for those of us who haven't been following this story?
Sure. So last week, last Monday, Mary Beckerle, who's the CEO and director of Huntsman Cancer Institute, got an email from U President David Pershing's office abruptly firing her. Technically, I guess it would be a demotion. She was no longer in that position, but returning to faculty. And there really wasn't a reason given why, and she had no idea it was coming. Mary's pretty beloved in the world of cancer research, so everyone was very surprised by this. I mean, we had cancer researchers protesting, and, you know, in meetings and going out on the street with signs. And so people were very unhappy with this. John Huntsman Sr. Really was in support of Mary and calling for her reinstatement. And at one point calling for the firing of Vivian Lee, who's the senior vice president of health sciences at the U. And so then on Tuesday, the Board of Trustees had a meeting that was about an hour and a half. And then later that day, they announced that Mary would be reinstated and that instead of reporting to Vivian Lee, she would be reporting directly to Pershing.
That was a pretty quick change of heart, it seems like. Did they give any specific reasons for it?
Not really. It's not super clear why the change was made so suddenly or, you know, what the origin of that original decision was. Just that, you know, she's going to be reporting directly to Pershing, which is what John Huntsman Sr. wanted. And that's pretty unique at the U and really anywhere. National experts have said that very few cancer centers have that kind of reporting relationship. And there isn't any on the clinical side of things at the U. No other entity has that kind of reporting relationship with Pershing.
So is this just a step to separate the Institute from health sciences in general?
That's not clear. They sort of operate separately, kind of. It's sort of hard to explain.
Yeah, it seems like a real gray area going on. And for the employees, too, the staff, they seem to be a little unsure.
Yeah, so it's not they have to develop this memorandum of understanding about how this is going to work. And so I think that's where we'll see whether this is sort of a move to further separate them. I think the Huntsmans just really wanted Vivian to have nothing to do with the Cancer Institute because of everything that was going on. But we're going to have to look at that agreement to really discern what that means moving forward.
George, the U put this to rest as quickly as they possibly could. What is the damage coming out of this situation?
Well, the damage mostly, I think, is probably to Vivian Lee's reputation. She, until this happened, she was a real rock star in the healthcare field. She was being written up in the New York Times and Fortune and Forbes and all these places as the person who was finally going to figure out healthcare, particularly how we pay for it. She was well known across the country as the person who came in and says, how much does it really cost to do a hip replacement? How much does it really cost to give somebody a transfusion? And they're all looking at her like, well, nobody ever asked us that question before. And she said, well, I'm asking you the question now. And so they were becoming really on the edge of figuring out how much stuff costs, how much it ought to cost, how you bill it, how you pay for it, which is kind of the unfulfilled piece of the Affordable Care Act and all kinds of health reform, is to get a handle on costs. So her reputation was sky high before this happened. And now the way the firing was handled, no reason was given. It was just an email. I mean, you don't fire a bank teller that way, much less somebody as prestigious as the CEO of the Huntsman Cancer Institute. They still haven't given us a reason. So people are left to speculate that there's some kind of personality conflict. There's questions about donations being given to the hospital or given to the cancer center or given to the U, and then it winds up being spent back to the company owned by the person who gave them all the money and who's responsible for that. And is there really anything wrong with that, or does it happen in healthcare all the time where all this money flows around? So, I mean, we don't know why she was reinstated. We don't know why she was fired in the first place. It's possible now that her job is apparently secure, that for the rest of the world, this is over.
Dan Harry?
I will say that if you haven't read it, you should read Alex Stuckey's report today in the Tribune, because what it reveals, which is fascinating, that you know, a lot of other department heads and other prominent individuals at the university in healthcare have been, you know, treated similarly in the past. It's just that they didn't receive the kind of attention or really much of any publicity at all when this happened, and it all traces back to Vivian Lee. Some of them are still feel like they, you know, got ambushed and they don't know the reasons that they were replaced. But as Alex also reported, you know, there are some real staunch supporters of Vivian Lee who say, you know, this is a transformative leader. And when you are that kind of personality, you are going to step on toes and you are going to make some enemies. And she has made enemies. But she's also, if you look at the results, had incredible results, as George mentioned. So really read that story. It provides some context that I think has been missing from this story.
Right. Alex, you haven't been able to talk to Vivian, have you?
I have not.
Not yet?
No.
Fingers crossed, hopefully soon. But you did, like Dan said, you spoke with a lot of people who have been affected by her in some way or other. Can you tell maybe one of those stories, maybe one that really surprised you?
Sure. I think, you know, after this happened, sort of like Dan was saying, I just got this flood of emails and phone calls of this happened to me or this happened to my boss. Our department's just not that big, you know, like the neurology department, for example, is not like HCI, you know. HCI is much bigger, obviously, and doesn't really have the Huntsmans to get upset about it, which is also, you know, a big part of this story about Mary Beckerle. But you know, I think, I guess the more recent one, like I said, was the neurology one. So that was the week before Mary was, so three weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago. And so it was very similar. I mean, she did call him into his office, into her office, but he had just had this paper published in a national scientific magazine, and you know, she said, good job, but we're sending you back to the lab. This is his account, of course. I haven't talked to Vivian. And so he was, he had negotiated a 5-year contract right around when Vivian first came to the U in 2011, because he kind of saw her making these moves, sort of getting rid of department heads. So he negotiated this contract, which is up September 30th. So she said, you know, you're done. You're returning to faculty as of October 1st. And so his, very similar to Mary, his department, you know, wrote a letter. They were very upset. They, you know, requested that the decision be reconsidered. And neither Pershing nor Lee responded to that letter. They say, so it's just a, you know, it's a parallel. It's a very similar story. And that's what I kept seeing, that, you know, these similar things were happening, that explanations were not really given. People were saying that they were unhappy with how she executed it, that they felt like they were doing what she wanted, and then they were just done. So yeah.
Well, thanks for your reporting. It really was an interesting story, just to see how many people really have been affected by some of those decisions. But really quickly, to wrap up, I want to talk about some possible legislative involvement in this. And Ben Wood wrote the story. He couldn't be here today, but Speaker of the House Greg Hughes says that they should be looking into what's going on at the U before a potential audit happens. Dan, I'm wondering, why is the state interested in getting involved in this, and what questions should they be asking?
There's a story that began with a healthcare publication, I think affiliated with the Boston Globe, and then the Tribune did a story, and others have done stories since, I think, the LA Times and Politico. It's a fascinating story. It's about a billionaire, multi-billionaire doctor named, I'm going to massacre his name, but it's Patrick Soon-Shiong. And this guy has built an incredible healthcare empire. And he donated, one of his companies donated $12 million to the university. And it was to be used for, I believe, genetic research, if I'm correct. And what happened was the $10 million of the $12 million went back to one of his companies. And so that raises all kinds of flags. Is this an attempt to launder money, essentially, that you are taking money that is a nonprofit that goes to a nonprofit entity and you get a tax break on it, and then you profit from it from your profit for-profit company? Nobody, you know, can say that definitively. What they can't say is there are some things about it that doesn't look right. One of them is, as the university admitted in one of the stories, is they allowed the foundation that donated the money to basically write the specifications for how this money would be used. And it just so happened that one of his companies met those specifications, and a very limited number of companies did. So there are kinds of questions, and that's what Greg Hughes is talking about, possibly asking for a legislative audit. And John Dougal, the state auditor who runs his own office, is talking about doing an audit of it. And at least in the case of Greg Hughes, I know he's an ally of the Huntsman family. And so I'm sure that he's immediately taken sides, and that's part of what's going on there.
And Alex Stuckey will be back in the studio next week, too, to report on that. Well, we have to go to a quick break. When we come back, it's a good time to be a jazz fan. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
The landmarks that span our rivers, roads, and railways are favourite musical subjects. The songs and tunes that commemorate them are as powerful as the structures themselves. But we're going to cross all forms of bridges when we meet up next for the Thistle and Shamrock. I hope you'll join me.
Join us tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
We want to ensure that we are not admitting into our country the very threats our soldiers are fighting overseas.
Refugees from 7 Muslim-majority countries.
Now protests, outrage, and backlash from President Trump's refugee ban.
You've heard reports on the current refugee crisis. Now we want to hear from you. Please fill out our survey at upr.org, and we'll use your answers to better help us as we cover this important topic.
This is Behind the Headlines. I'm Emily Means with KCPW Public Radio, and we rarely talk about sports on this show, so I'm excited to have our next reporters in. We've got Aaron Falk, Tribune sports reporter, in the studio with us. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, I'm glad you said sports, because I think everyone was going to hear Utah Jazz and think Steve Williams was going to be up next. And so if you're disappointed, I apologize.
I've got a follow-up question for you on that one, but we'll get to it in a bit. And then we also have Twitter star and jazz reporter Tony Jones on the phone with us. Hi, Tony.
Don't say Twitter star, please.
Aw, but you tweet so good, Tony.
Hey, I tweet too much.
You can make up for my lack of tweeting, so thanks for doing that. But of
thanks
course, the Utah Jazz in the NBA playoffs. And just a reminder to listeners, if you love the Jazz or if you love the Clippers, you can join us in this conversation, 801-355-8255. You can also comment on our Facebook page at KCPW 88.3. And we want to know if you scored some tickets to tonight's game. So let us know. Join the conversation. And I'm going to be honest, I don't know too much about basketball, Aaron and Tony. But it is exciting to live in Utah and be a Jazz fan right now. When was the last time the Jazz were in the playoffs?
So it had been 5 years before since they'd last made the playoffs, 7 years since their last playoff win. If they win tonight, it'll be the first time that they've advanced to the second round since 2010. So it's been a long time. You can definitely tell from the fans in that arena that they're pretty excited. They've had a lot of pent-up frustration, a lot of time to think about this.
What's different about this year's team, Tony?
Say that again? I'm sorry.
What is different about this year's team from years past?
I think... You know, number one, they're just better. I mean, it's just a better team. You know, Dennis Lindsay, the Jazz GM, has been putting this team together for the better part of 3 or 4 years. And, you know, this is the year that they finally matured. Gordon Hayward's having a career year. Rudy Gobert's blossomed to a star. And then they brought some veteran help to help the young guys. And obviously Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw and George Hill, those three have had a significant impact, you know, throughout the regular season. And now you're seeing even more of an impact in the playoffs. So, you know, Dennis Lindsay has built this team slowly. He's been pretty meticulous about the moves and that he's made. And you know, this is the kind of the year that this team is coming to age.
So you mentioned Gobert, who's usually a key player, from what I understand.
He is indeed.
And he seems to be. But who are some people, some players who've surprised you in the playoffs? Aaron?
I mean, I don't know if it's a surprise because he's done a lot of this throughout the year, but I think you're seeing some surprise nationally with what Joe Johnson's done. He's 35 years old. He's the oldest guy on the team. He's been around the league for 16 years, and for so long he was associated with having, one, a very huge and bad contract, and two, for a nickname that he doesn't like, ISO Joe, which isolation means he's alone. He kind of, you know, skewed the team for his own offense, which has not been true with the Jazz at all. He's been great. He's saved them in game one with the game winner in LA, and in game four with Hayward out with food poisoning, he scored 28 points and was incredible. Apparently a testament to what a regular Bikram yoga practice can do. So at 35, he's still killing it.
Maybe he can look forward to a new nickname after this series. I don't know.
Yeah, he has another one. It's Joe Jesus, which was given to him by a former teammate, Kevin Garnett. He's not always there when you call on him, but he's always there when you need him, and he has been for the Jazz in this series.
I like that. George Pyle, you are still in the studio with us. I'm so happy to have you. Are you a big Jazz fan?
Well, I am now. I mean, Fred, this is this is a real fair weather fan kind of thing. I mean,
I appreciate your honesty.
Well, no, I mean, I've been following it even before we lived in Salt Lake City. You go back to when the days of Stockton and Malone. People all across the country followed them. They were quite the team, and then they're gone, and then the team goes through this period in the wilderness. And, you know, every place I've lived, it's like a small market pro team. I lived in Kansas City. You know, the Royals were on hard times for a long time. You lived in Buffalo. The Sabres just and the Bills just never quite there. And, I mean, just and of course, you know, as a political writer, I asked these guys, I mean, apparently part of the reason that anything happens is people spend money. So, I mean, you were talking about the veteran players. Did they go out and spend some money, or were they just lucky in finding these guys?
You know, a bit of luck and a bit of great planning. I mean, one, Dennis Lindsay, the general manager, is kind of they've had a lower payroll than many teams for a long time, and that's kind of kept some flexibility. So at the trade or at the draft last June, they were able to make a trade, and they had the cap space to bring in George Hill, who became their starting point guard. They had the money to give Joe Johnson, you know, $11 million a year, which is basically a bargain for Joe Johnson at this point, which sounds insane to say, but you know, and then luck. I mean, to draft Rudy Gobert, who is in fact a key contributor
to
the
team. He's
the
guy, right?
27th pick in the draft, when so many other teams had passed over him, you kind of stumble into to a key player like that. You know, it's always a bit of both.
So, Tony, okay, looking at tonight's game, which is a big one, how will we match up with the Clippers on this game?
Well, I think the Jazz are going to have to prepare themselves for a real keeping helping of Chris Paul, because, you know, Chris Paul is the Clippers point guard, and he's one of the best point guards, in my estimation, to ever play the game of basketball. And he's one of the best point guards in the league currently, still at the top of his game. And, you know, he's a guy who's just not going to go down without a fight. And he's known in his career, you know, to pull off big playoff victories, you know, kind of single-handedly. So he's going to come out and really try to take this game over tonight for the Clippers, and the Jazz are going to have to ready themselves for that. You know, obviously, from the Jazz perspective, this is, you know, such a big game. It's one of the biggest games that they've had in the last decade. You know, so I think nerves are going to be a part of it. You know, this is the first home closeout game that they've had since 2010 when they beat the Denver Nuggets. So, you know, I think nerves are going to be a part of it. So, you know, I think, you know, kind of being on an even keel emotionally. That's gonna help the Jazz, and I think, you know, executing offensively and defensively, making their shots offensively when they present themselves, getting stops, defensive stops, all of that stuff is gonna have a huge impact on whether the Jazz advance to the second round in the Golden State Warriors, or whether we are all heading to Los Angeles for Game 7 on Sunday.
Let's say we do win tonight. Like you said, we're playing Golden State after that. The best team in the league, right?
Correct.
As I understand.
not only the best team in the league, but you can make an argument that this Golden State team is the most talented team in NBA history.
You want to make that argument here on the radio today, Tony?
Public radio hot takes, Tony. Let's hear them.
Hot takes. Are the Jazz scared? Are they scared if they win this game, they're going to have to go up against the best team, arguably, in NBA history?
Well, I don't think they're scared. I mean, I think that the Jazz are one of the few teams in the league that have, you know, kind of parts on their team that can make this Golden State team pause, which is they have a dominant center who's dominant on both ends of the floor. And I think that that's the one area where the Warriors aren't as strong as they are everywhere else. And the Jazz are a team that, you know, pace of play, you know, they're really meticulous in the way they play. So, you know, they play possession by possession. They milk possessions and they limit possessions. So, you know, the Warriors, they're a lot more free-flowing. They want to get out and transition more. They want to get a lot more shots up, and the Jazz are going to want to get more shots up. So they play differently than Golden State, and I think that helps Jazz as well. Now, that being said, you know, if the Jazz were to somehow beat Golden State, it would almost no question be one of the three or four or five biggest upsets in the history of the league and playoff history. So, you know, that's the kind of hill that the Jazz are going to be looking at climbing if they should advance past the Clippers and meet the Warriors.
Aaron, I want you to take a look back at the season and think about what the Jazz need to do to improve for next year. Are we losing any players? Sorry, just
yeah.
Break
well,
in.
I mean,
who
the,
are we losing?
the biggest question mark in coming in or going into the summer is going to be what Gordon Hayward does. Gordon Hayward's their all-star forward. He can opt out of his contract come July, and he certainly will. I mean, he's had the best year of his career, and the NBA salary cap is about to go up. It's going to be, you know, a historic level of. I mean, he's going to make a huge, huge amount of money.
Who wants Gordon?
Everyone, basically. I mean, he's going to get the maximum amount allowed from pretty much anyone that can give it to him. And it's going to come down to, you know, the Jazz have some incumbent advantages. The way the collective bargaining agreement is, if you have the rights to a player, you can offer them a little bit more money. But Gordon Hayward's a guy who really does value winning, so it's going to come down to whether he thinks Utah's the best place for him or not to win a championship. And so that's why I think, you know, advancing to the second round means a lot more to the Jazz than even the Clippers, because whoever plays the Warriors, let's face it, it's a likely sweep, you know, four games and done. I think it means a lot more to the Jazz to get there, to know that, hey, we're a team that can get to the second round and we're a few pieces away from advancing, than it does for the Clippers, who are also facing a very, you know, difficult summer where they could lose their stars. They're already missing one of their all-star forwards, Blake Griffin. And if they make it to the second round, get swept by the Golden State Warriors, it means nothing to them. I mean, they're a team that with championship aspirations that has no chance of winning a championship. Jazz have, you know, aspirations of eventually becoming a championship caliber team. So just advancing would be a huge accomplishment for them.
All right. We got to wrap it up so we can get to our very last segment, Underplayed Stories of the Week. But I want your score predictions, all of you. Aaron Falk, George Pyle, and Tony Jones, give me your score predictions for tonight.
Tony, why don't you kick it off?
Oh, you guys want me to go first?
Yeah, we do.
I'm going to say the Jazz win 109-97. I think sometimes in a series, one team just figures out the other, And I think the Jazz have figured out the Clippers. I think that the turning point of the series was last Sunday when the Clippers were ahead of the Jazz 2-1, and they had the Jazz down in the fourth quarter, 87-80, and the Jazz were able to rally and win that game. And they were able to win game five on the road. And I think that the Jazz have just figured the Clippers out, and I think that they're going to win. So 109-97.
All right, George Pyle.
Oh, gee, I'm not enough of an expert. I would call it for the Jazz. They're playing at home. They're playing for their own history. And I would think it maybe would be a little closer than what Tony's saying, but I have no idea whether this is the kind of thing that's going to be a real high-scoring game or a tighter game. I would think it probably come down to the very end like it has in the past earlier in the series.
Yeah, through five games, these teams have scored the exact same amount of points, number of points exactly. So I think it's going to be a closer game than Tony predicts. I mean, the score line, you know, these games have all been sort of grinded out, I would guess, somewhere just about 100, you know, 99 to 101 for the Jazz, somewhere in there, and you know, maybe they win by 4 or 5 points. Jazz is just a deeper team right now. The Clippers have a very shallow bench, and you know, I think the Jazz pulled this one off at home.
We just have to make sure Gordon Hayward eats at home.
No more eating out. No. Cook your chicken all the way through, Gordon.
Okay, no more eating a sandwich from a place.
Yeah, I think I ate a sandwich from that place once, too. Just I went back, but no more tuna salad.
To be safe, just don't eat any more sandwiches. Okay, we have 1 minute left, and I want your underplayed stories of the week, but I need them in about 15-second bursts. So, Aaron Falk, you first.
The Jazz don't have a lot of celebrity fans, but the pink grandmas, if you've ever been to a game, you've seen them, and one of them fell, Keiko Mori. She fell. She's been watching the game from her hospital room with her sister. You know, get well. Hope to see you back there soon.
All right, George Pyle?
Well, back to earlier things about the monument and everything, we found out that there's a whole lot more Navajos in San Juan County than maybe we thought. If they actually get counted and if they actually vote, then the whole political situation down there could really change.
That's interesting. And Tony Jones?
Joe Jesus is my underplayed story of the week. He's not always there when you need him, but he's always there. He's not always there when you want him, but he's always there when you need him. And Joe Johnson has been the story and the Jazz savior, so to speak, for this series. And I think that it continues tonight.
Joe Jesus hoping to pull us through for a win on this game tonight. Hey, guys, thank you all for joining me today. Really appreciate you having you in. And, Tony, we'll have to see you in person sometime.
Don't put me on the spot. It was almost like I was there.
It was almost like that. You're right. All right. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, to Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio. Also to Roger McDonough. We hope you're enjoying your vacation and not checking your work email. Thanks also to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program on iTunes, at our website, kcpw.org, or however you get your podcasts. Up next on KCPW Presents, Episode 4 of The Response, America's Story. Americans from across the country share their stories of President Trump's first days in office. For KCPW, I'm Emily Means. Have a lovely weekend.
At the turn of the 20th century, New York City was terrorized by a ruthless criminal gang.
In one instance, they actually cut the arms off a man who they used as sort of a walking billboard to advertise the true terrors of the Black Hand.
Stephen Tolte on the Society of the Black Hand and the man who dedicated his life to bringing it down. Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
Join us Saturday from 6 to 9 on Utah Public Radio.
A statewide service of Utah State University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences. This is KUSR Logan, KUSUFM Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, Moab, KUST Price, KCEU, and streaming online at upr.org.